Hello and welcome to Inside Education. My name is Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. Coming up on today's program.
My ambition is to write well, to write material that will not only appeal to people but will make them think and help them understand their own lives better.
We'll hear from how one nonfiction writer from New York City who recently featured on the program goes about writing his books. But first, we go closer to home. The Northside Partnership is one of a number of initiatives around the country that grew up in the last decade or so to promote social inclusion and to create sustainable and vibrant communities. Others include the Ballymun-Whitehall Area Partnership, the Canal Communities Partnership and the Dodder Valley Partnership. Noel Kelly works on the Preparing for Life project with the Northside Partnership and was formerly the Education Officer with the partnership. I first met up with him to find out more about the partnership. I began by asking him, who are the partners in the Northside Partnership?
Well, I suppose, first of all, John, I'll just tell you where the partnership came from. The partnership was established in 1991 by government at the time, and it was as a response to long-term unemployment. So a number of partnership companies were set up in unemployment black spots around the country. And the key partners in it are politicians, the unions, trade unions, businesses and the local community. So it's a combination of the four different working together. So Northside Partnership's directors are drawn from those four pillars. So we would have representatives from each section.
And the immediate need for the partnership came from long-term unemployment and its consequences, presumably.
Yeah, long-term unemployment, you know, in the Dublin 17 area particularly, but in significant parts of Northside was you know, extremely high at that stage. And I suppose government were struggling to figure out how are we going to address this. So the idea of setting up the partnerships was that you had a local response to support people, hopefully, back into employment. But I think what emerged fairly quickly when we started looking at it in Northside is that a pattern emerged among people who were long-term unemployed. And generally, these people also had low educational attainment. So there's a direct correlation between unemployment and education. Now, obviously, at the moment, that's slightly skewed because even people with high quality education qualifications at the moment can't get jobs. But certainly in the 90s, definitely your education, your level of education was a direct relative to whether you were employed or not.
And Noel, the partnership involves a lot more than just education, although we're interested in discussing the educational side of it. But I wonder, could you just say what are the other dimensions to it?
Yeah, I suppose that there are four key dimensions in the partnership. One of them is employment services, which is very much around working with people who are either job seekers or are preparing for work. We also have an enterprise section, which supports people who want to start up their own businesses. And again, that's thriving at the moment. In times of high employment, the enterprise section would dip. But at the moment, because people can't find work, there are lots of people who are just having a go at setting up their own business. We also then have a community development section, which is really around working with various community organisations that are involved in community development. And then our education and learning section would be the fourth key section.
So you're in charge of the education section.
Well, I'm not really in charge now. I was education coordinator for a number of years, but I've now moved full time to work on Preparing for Life. But the development of the Preparing for Life program would have happened when I was education coordinator. So I had that position for about 6 years.
Okay, and what exactly is the education remit? What does that involve for the Northside Partnership?
I suppose what the partnership tried to do is to try and find a niche where there are gaps in the system and to try and close those. So in Northside, we have a range of programs that range really from the cradle to the grave. And I might just run you through those fairly quickly. As we've just been talking about, the Preparing for Life program is really targeted at 0 to 4s. We then have a regional schools network, which is an effort to engage the 68 schools across the partnership area in some joint thinking and some joint actions. And the kind of things we do there, we would have quite a lot of teacher training, so options for teachers around classroom management and around, you know, various teaching skills. We also have just completed an innovative reading initiative with the Merino Institute of Education. So we're always looking at adding value. Now, obviously, we don't have the capacity to work with all the kids in the area, so what we end up doing are pilot programs or smaller programs. We also then, for second level students, we have a program called Challenger, which is very much based in the Dublin 17 area, and this is specifically designed to address when it was established in the 1990s was the poor levels of school completion in the Dublin 17 area. So what happens here is 30 children are identified in fifth class primary each year, and we work with those children outside of school hours right up until their leaving cert, with the aim of, number one, getting them to complete leaving cert, and number two, hopefully encouraging them to go on to further education. And those kids get a lot of supports, from visits to universities to extra tuition to speech and drama. So it's really around trying to build their confidence and their courage to actually stay in education and to go on. We then have a range of supports at third level for students from low-income or welfare-dependent families. We've been operating a scheme called the Millennium Fund very successfully for the last 13 or 14 years. And again, we'd have between 300 and 400 students a year that are supported. We have a full-time guidance counsellor, so they have access to guidance service at all times. And also, we provide some financial support if they need it. Unfortunately, in the most recent budget, that the government have withdrawn funding for that programme. So that's something that we're very anxious about, because we know that the support we give these students can be the difference between their ability to attend college or not. We also have an education trust fund, which is supported by local businesses. And again, that's been running for about the last 10 years. Again, we give scholarships to students from welfare-dependent, low-income families from that. We also would do quite a lot of advocacy on behalf of people. So people of all ages, abilities, and with all kinds of issues in relation to education would come to the partnership. And if at all possible, we'll try and help them. It may be to access a grant. It may be to access a place in college. It may be that they've run into difficulty in college and they need somebody to negotiate on their behalf. We also, there are a range of other initiatives, like we've done quite a bit on traveller education, trying to encourage traveller children to stay on in school. We also support a number of other training services like Youth Reach, Community Training Centre. So I suppose we have our finger in a lot of pies, and really what we're trying to do is to add value to the people, the mainstream educators who are out there, and trying to see where there are gaps.
And that was Noel Kelly of the Northside Partnership. You can find out more about the initiative at northsidepartnership.ie. You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Podcasts of previous programmes can be downloaded from iTunes or from our website, which is www.insideed.com. You can contact the programme on 086 8962 665. Earlier this year on Inside Education, I spoke to David Schenk about his new book, The Genius in All of Us. In that interview, David told us about the relationship between genes and our upbringing and how they influence what each of us can do creatively. I found it interesting to talk to David Schenk because he is not an educator, but he's a full-time writer. In the past, he has written books about such varied topics as data smog, chess and Alzheimer's disease. So, because he wrote a book on education, I wanted to find out more about how a non-fiction writer goes about his work. So I asked David to tell me some more about what he does. I began by asking him how it came about that he chose this time to write about genes and genius.
Well, I suppose the first answer is that I write about what I'm personally curious about. And I also look for topics that haven't yet been adequately explored for a general reading audience. In the case of Alzheimer's, for example, when I wrote The Forgetting about a decade ago, there was already tons of great science on Alzheimer's disease, and there were a lot of books by scientists and also by caregivers about their individual experience, but there just simply wasn't a big, expansive, ambitious biography of the disease, that explained the history of the disease, which is quite deep and interesting, and what Alzheimer's actually does to the brain in lay kind of general language. So there was an opportunity there just in terms of public education, and I was fascinated by the topic, and so I did it. There isn't a giant career plan here where I've mapped out the 20 subjects that I want to do, but I'm kind of, checking off the checks boxes as I go along. It's just a matter of what I'm curious about and also what I think just hasn't been adequately done. So to fast forward to this book, I stumbled the basic question of how is it that some of us get really good at stuff, and how is it that some of us seem to be, you know, mired in mediocrity or worse? That's a universal question. I think one that virtually everyone is interested in on some level or another. We all want to understand, you know, how it is that we got to be who we are, and we all want to understand what our potential is. So these are things that we all think about, and certainly I have thought about a lot in my life. And what happened a few years ago is I simply stumbled into a couple different pieces of research which suggested that scientists are coming up with some really interesting answers to these questions that haven't really been well translated to the general public. So I saw an opportunity both to understand it more myself and to bring a couple different arenas of science to help people understand genes better, but also to connect that to this relatively new body of science called expertise studies, which is the study of how people get good at stuff, and to show how all the science in a lot of different areas, including parenting and early child psychology, are all really pointing in the direction of skills and abilities being a matter of process and not innate quantities.
So you're coming at this book then as an interested layperson rather than an expert. So what is the process then of writing the book like from the time you decide, okay, this is the kind of topic I'm going to work on now?
Well, it's they say that that making laws is like making sausage, and you don't really want to see the process. And I think that making any kind of art is the same way, and certainly writing is the same way. It's a very messy process, and it's very complicated, and there isn't a science to it. In my case, it's having a lot of questions, recognizing somewhere in the back of my brain that these curiosities are powerful enough questions for me that they're going to be questions that I'm going to want to spend a lot of time with, doing a lot of research, sometimes in a fairly methodical way and sometimes in a fairly bumbling way, just kind of, you know, going where my intuition takes me, and also just, you know, reading stuff in order of how I happen to bump into it. And over time, assembling just a kind of a broad understanding of how I might answer these questions for myself, and therefore how I might answer them for the general public. What you said before is absolutely right. I'm doing this as a member of the general public. I am not a scientist. I'm really not an expert in anything. So I kind of think of myself as an ambassador for the general public. I dive into an area of someone else's expertise or many people's expertise, and I try to understand it as an outsider. And once I have a kind of a vague understanding, I try to put that into words. And of course, writing is a way of understanding, not just a way of communicating, but a way of understanding. So for myself, I try to put that into words and over time, come up with, you know, the questions become stabs at answers, which then become, very crude drafts of chapters and book outlines and things like that. And I'm lucky enough that I'm able to spend so far in the books that you mentioned several years to develop, rather nuanced answers to these very complex questions. If I had to do it quickly, the answers wouldn't be nearly as interesting.
So you have all these questions, and then do you go to libraries? Do you do research online? Do you meet people and talk to them? Is it a combination of all of these?
Yeah, very much all of the above. The internet has obviously changed nonfiction writing and journalism tremendously. It used to be that it was just about all about going to the library and going to find people and hunting them down on the phone. And now it's a lot of it takes place online. Even the library part, most of that takes place online. So, which is a blessing in that you can access more and more, and you can reach people and get answers from and interact with people all around the world so quickly. That's amazing. The kind of downside to all of that is that I do more and more of my research actually just from my own laptop in a room. And it's not as interesting, you know, aesthetically or kind of experientially. I don't get to go to all these exotic places as much as I would have had to before, because I don't need to. But it's all of the above, and it's talking to as many people. And then an essential part of the process for me is after I develop what feels like a pretty good understanding of how to answer, you know, these questions that I have. Showing my material to the experts and developing relationships with experts that I trust and saying, okay, here's how I'm understanding this. Here's how I'm trying to, you know, explain it to my audience. Does this make sense back to you? And getting corrected by people, because obviously I'm not the person with the, you know, with the deep technical knowledge. And there's going to be a process where I do make mistakes, technical mistakes in conveying this information. So, there's that middle period where I'm writing, but I'm also checking my facts and also my characterizations with the true experts.
And at an earlier stage where you're still doing research, do you write at the same time as you're doing research, or do you do a lot of research first and then sit down and start writing?
You know, it's heavy research in the beginning, but then it just becomes a hodgepodge of everything. The research never stops. At a certain point, the writing starts and it becomes a back and forth process or an interwoven process between writing stuff, realizing that I have a gap in my knowledge, going to find the right person or the right paper or the right book or what have you to try to answer that, or coming up with a particular metaphor. So doing some deep thinking on that, or talking with my wife or my 7-year-old son, or, you know, whatever it takes to kind of work through this material. Often, I mean, I talked already about, you know, reaching out and finding people, experts, but an equally important part of the process for me is talking to my mom and talking, you know, showing my material to people who don't understand this stuff and saying, does this make sense to you? Am I using the right metaphor? Am I using compelling metaphors? Am I conveying this stuff? You know, because it's one thing to help, you know, explain it to myself, but in the end, I want as many, you know, anyone who can read, you know, who's literate, to understand, you know, the ideas and for these things to have a powerful impression and connect with people. So that's also an important part of the process.
And for somebody who's interested in the process, you know, they might say, well, it's all very well for David Schenck. He has several best-selling books under his belt and, you know, he has resources there that he can build on. But this must be a very expensive process in terms of time and in terms of the research. How did you begin, say, when in your first book? How did you get the resources behind you that you needed in order to take the time to write a good book, and a good nonfiction book?
Well, there are a lot of compliments woven into that question, so I thank you for those. But it's true. I am at a point where, I mean, nothing is free and easy to me, and I don't just decide I'm going to write a book and suddenly get, you know, a nice check to do it. But it's true that I'm at a point where I do have a lot of advantages and access to publishers and agents and you know, grants and things like that are blessings. And it is more difficult in many respects to get started. But ultimately, I mean, it starts with an ambition and a seriousness of purpose. And high standards. You never want to. You should be your own toughest critic. And I have been a lesson that I learned early on, actually in college, when I was developing an ambition to become a literary nonfiction writer, author. I learned that just because it rolled off my tongue or my pen or my word processor didn't make it a great sentence or a great paragraph, that that I should constantly look at my own work and my own ideas with extreme skepticism. You know, I should let the ideas and the words flow, but then I should go back and just assume that they're not so great until I prove to myself and to others that they are interesting, that they are compelling. So having just incredibly high standards and trying to live up to those, and then using those high standards to develop work and questions who will then impress other people and get the agent that can introduce you to the great editor and writing a proposal a book proposal that impresses a publisher. It's a matter of taking the time and doing hard work, and I've had plenty of advantages and resources, and I'm very blessed in that respect. But it also comes down to just having a high ambition and having very high standards in your life,
and having a lot of discipline, I presume.
Discipline comes with the. For me, discipline just comes with the skepticism and the high standards. I mean, I don't really think of myself as having a lot of personal discipline, but I do expect myself to do great work. You know, my ambition is to write well, to write material that will not only appeal to people, but will make them think and help them understand their own lives better. Of course, I have, I have idols, and I have, great books that I was brought up on and that I admire and that to me are the models for great nonfiction literature. I don't think for a second that I'm there, but I have those high standards, and the discipline then follows with follows the high standards in my case.
And who are some of your idols or some of the works that you really admire in nonfiction?
Oh, gee. Well, for me, it's there were a handful of people in high school and college that I read that really just set this standard for what some people call literary nonfiction. Somewhat awkward term, but I guess it's the best we have. John McPhee, E.B. White, Joan Didion, Tom Wolfe are the four names that really stand out, at least right now in my mind. People who wanted to bring a level of art and sophistication and nuance to the communication of real life in a way that for many, many, many generations and decades and centuries, people have been bringing to writing fiction. So kind of elevating nonfiction to the level of the novel and of great fiction writing.
And your typical writing day, David, what's that like?
Typical writing day. I guess the flip answer would be that it shouldn't be too typical. You want to kind of mix it up. And in my case, my tension is that I live a family life, and that I the best thing that works, the most efficient thing that works for me and my family is to have a kind of office hours and to work from 9 to 5 or 9 to 6 or whatever it is. The difficulty there is that's not always when the ideas and inspiration come. Sometimes, as any writer or creator knows, sometimes it's 1 in the morning and you just feel like, wow, now's the time to get some ideas out, or ideas are coming to you that that are, when you're just staring at the computer screen, you're not getting the answers. But when but after you have a nice meal or you're feeling very tired or drifting off to sleep, suddenly, oh, that's how I should answer that question, or that's the metaphor I should use, that's the way I should introduce that idea. So there's kind of, for me, there's kind of the tension between the banker's hours that I theoretically lead, but then quite often, several times a week, if not more, I find myself kind of awkwardly thrust into, you know, writing late into the night or getting up early in the morning or even in the middle of the night, getting up and doing work and you know, at least trying to get the idea in my head down on paper before it, you know, fades into oblivion.
And David, you're here in Edinburgh to talk about your latest book, The Genius in All of Us. Are you working on your next book? And can you tell us what it's about?
Yes and no. I can't tell you what it's about, not because I'm ultra secretive, but because I'm just my next book is any one of, I don't know, a dozen different things, and I'm working on just a bunch of different ideas. Part of my ambition now is to actually to do some fiction writing. So I'm at a strange point in my career, what may turn out to be a strange point. It may just be that I go on and keep writing nonfiction, and that would be, you know, certainly a blessing in and of itself. And I have some I think fairly ambitious and interesting nonfiction ideas that I'm exploring and talking about with my agent and with the editor that I've been with for several books now. But I also have some ideas for fiction, for fictional storytelling, and I'm playing with those, and I don't know really, you know, where that leads, but I'm having fun with it, at least for now.
David Schenk, thanks very much for talking to me.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed this.
And David Schenk's website address is davidschenk.com, and Schenk is spelled S-H-E-N-K. Just before we go, I might mention that an education story that's likely to make the news and we're likely to hear a lot about in the coming week is how we're doing as a country in literacy and numeracy. On Tuesday, December the 7th, we'll find out how our 15-year-old students performed in reading, maths and science compared to 15-year-olds in 64 other countries. For the first time this year, the PISA results will show how student performance has evolved over time by comparing the reading, maths and science results with PISA surveys from 2000, 2003 and 2006. That's it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com or on iTunes. You can email us on insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.